All right, let's go to Proverbs chapter 23. And our subject is how the righteous view money. And we have under that 5 points. Number one, the righteous understand the limitations of money, which we covered last hour. Cannot meet spiritual needs. And now we're ready for the second one, and the third and the fourth in this hour. And our second one is the righteous understand the fleeting nature of money. The righteous understand its fleeting nature. And we're looking at Proverbs 23 and verse 4, which says, "Do not weary yourself to gain wealth." Now, verse 4 is not meant to depreciate wealth. Verse 4 is not meant to say, be lazy and make no attempt to gain material possessions. That is not what he's driving at. The point involved when he says, "Do not weary yourself to gain wealth," is the idea of don't concentrate all of your efforts on it. Don't make that everything in life. That's a legitimate thing, but don't make that everything. So do not weary yourself. That is, do not make it your only goal to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. Now, what is the rationale behind that? Why shouldn't we do it? Because if we make that our only pursuit, we're missing something. We're not looking at the fact that money has a fleeting nature. And notice the way that comes on in verse 5. Verse 5 is the rationale behind not making seeking money our goal. Verse 5 says, "When you set your eyes on it, it's gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings, like an eagle that flies toward the heavens." So the emphasis is on the fleeting nature of wealth. And we could put with that a couple of remarks that might fix it in our mind. And the first one is this. Have you ever seen a Brinks truck following the hearse to the cemetery? Or when someone says of a very wealthy person, "Boy, how much do you think he left?" And the answer to that is always the same. He left everything. It's a fleeting type of thing. It is not permanent, and there's the emphasis. And it's the perspective that the righteous have as far as money is concerned. Look at Proverbs 27. In verse 23. Verse 23 is simply saying that you ought to take very good care of what you've got. And the reason for taking very good care of what you have is to recognize it can disappear so quickly. So, verse 23, "Know well the condition of your flocks and pay attention to your herds." He's simply saying, have a good grasp of the material possessions you've got for this reason. Riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the grass disappears, the new growth is seen, and so forth. So notice the emphasis is, take care of what you've got. Well, we had two emphases. The one in chapter 23 is don't set all of your ambition on gaining it because it's fleeting. This is saying, take care of what you've got. And the reason for taking care of what you've got, expressed in terms of your flocks and your herds, is because they're not forever. So one is saying, don't set your hope on it in chapter 23, and this one is saying that we ought to take care of what we got, and it is because the righteous understand the fleeting nature of money. All right, next. The righteous understand a third thing. They understand that money can give a false sense of security. They understand it can give a false sense of security. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 15. I have three passages on this. First one is Proverbs 10, verse 15. Verse 15, I think, has really two thoughts in it. One is good and one is bad. The first sense is good in that when we have certain material possessions, we do have a certain security. It says the rich man's wealth is his fortress, his security. The ruin, by way of contrast, the ruin of the poor is their poverty. And so I think you have a good note in this verse that for the rich man, wealth does provide a fortress. But the verse is simply saying there is a certain security involved in it. that thing can be taken to extreme and it can become a false sense of security. Chapter 11, verse 28. Chapter 10, verse 15 is saying it's good. It can give you a fortress. It can give you security. However, don't trust it. Chapter 11, verse 28. It says, he who trusts in his riches will fall. I think one of the beautiful things about Proverbs is the balance it gives. If we would say that money does not give security, hey, you've got to back off for just a moment. That's true in a sense, but it's also untrue in a sense, is it not? Here is a person that has saved well, and in their old age, they are able to live comfortably. For what reason? Because you have some material goods, so there is a sense in which it provides a security. However, is there also a false sense of security that can come out of it? And Proverbs recognizes both. 10:15 recognizes it can give legitimate security. 11:28 says, be careful. That can be taken to the sense of giving a false security, therefore do not trust it. Chapter 18 and verse 11, it says, a rich man's wealth is his strong city. And like a high wall in his own, what? Imagination. And therefore, the righteous recognize what? That money can give a false sense of security. It is legitimate to have, but be very careful, it can give a false sense of security. This accords with the New Testament also in 1 Timothy 6. All right, fourth point on the way the righteous view money. They understand that money cannot substitute for integrity. They understand it cannot substitute for integrity. In other words, you may have a great deal of money, but you're dishonest, and you can't substitute that money for dishonesty. Chapter 22, verse 1. Notice that more important than the money we have is the integrity that we have. And you have that in 22:1, which says, a good name is more to be desired than great riches. In other words, it's better to have a good reputation for your integrity than it is to be wealthy. And favor is better than silver and gold. Notice also 28:6. Substantiating the point that the righteous understand that money cannot substitute for integrity. Verse 6 of chapter 28. Better is the poor who walks in his integrity than he who is crooked, though he be rich. And what is he simply saying? Well, our summary sentence. You cannot substitute material possessions for integrity. And now, fourth and last on his view of money, the righteous understand it does not deliver from death. It does not deliver from death. The rich man, as well as the poor man, must face death, and that is a reality. Proverbs 11 and verse 4. Proverbs 11 and verse 4. It is so easy on the part of those accumulating money to be thinking about the now and forget about there is a someday when God is met. And in 11:4 it says, riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. So the important thing to accumulate is righteousness, first of all, in the sense of justification by faith in Jesus Christ, and second, experiential righteousness, because other things that we may pursue will not deliver from death. All right, that is how the righteous views money. Now, number two, how the righteous gains his money. How the righteous views it, and now how he gains his money. And we will have three things here. Number one, he gains it by right action. He does not gain his money by underhanded deals. He gains it by right action. Proverbs 10 and verse 2. We will have two passages here. We'll have Proverbs 10 and verse 2. And Proverbs 20 and verse 17 that says the way the righteous gain money is by doing what is right. Chapter 10 verse 2, ill-gotten gains do not profit. That's sort of a seeming contradiction there, because when you have the gains, you've got profit. But in the real sense, they do not profit. Ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. Second passage is chapter 20 and verse 17. The same concept, 20:17. Incidentally, in 2017, two or three Sundays ago, we went over the afterwards of Proverbs, how Proverbs never lets us forget that there is an afterwards to all of our actions. And if you do this, then afterwards, this is going to happen. And Proverbs is filled with them, and I gave you a number, and since have found two more that I overlooked, and here is one of them. Verse 17, bread obtained by falsehood is sweet to a man. In other words, you have gained something by sweet talk, and you have the satisfaction of, did I ever fool him? Did I ever get gain from him? And he says, that is sweet, but afterward. And I don't know of any more telling metaphor than this one here, because you can just feel it. His mouth is filled with gravel. Can you make anything more distasteful than a whole mouthful of gravel? Dry, dry gravel in the mouth. And he's emphasizing then that the righteous understand that the way you gain money is by integrity, by right action. Second, it's very simply saying here that sin has a bad aftertaste to it. But we very often don't think of the aftertaste. I never think of the aftertaste. One of the few times, I think it was Thursday night, about 11:30, I had a chili fit. And I made some and loaded about a third of a bottle of Tabasco and chopped up some onions in it, and a little bit of vinegar. The vinegar you put in, red peppers in a bottle, you know, then pour vinegar in it, let it marinate. And loaded that up, and lots of cayenne, and I felt it all day the next day. I don't know why. That sort of concoction has an aftertaste. But at the moment, I wanted the taste of it, and it was sweet, it was delicious, it was good, and I did not want to consider the afterwards at all, but the afterwards nonetheless comes. And he's emphasizing this right here, that we may gain something by the wrong action. But remember, sin has an aftertaste. Okay. The second idea about his money is he gains it by hard work. And if you think I learned anything from that incident, you're mistaken. I will do it again. And again and again and again. Only one prayer that I've really kind of leaned on and asked for is that, number one, I do not want to die in bed. May I please die at my desk studying with a stomach full of chili. Okay, Proverbs 12, verse 11. At age 103. Okay. Proverbs 12 and verse 11. Notice the emphasis here is on hard work. It says, he who tills his land, and that spells work. He who tills his land will have plenty of bread, but he who pursues vain things lacks sense. Proverbs 14 and verse 23. This has lots of wisdom in it. It's so much easier to talk about what we're going to do than to do it. It says, in all labor there is profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. So the emphasis again on hard work. Chapter 28 and verse 19. And in verse 19 is the emphasis on pursue the hard work of the things you have at hand rather than fruitless pursuits. Verse 19, who tills his land, and that spells out work, will have plenty of food, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty in plenty. Interesting expression, isn't it? Poverty in plenty, an abundance of poverty. So notice the emphasis. How does the righteous gain his money, his material possessions? He does the right thing, and he works hard. Second, or third rather, he plans his investment. By planning his investment. Chapter 21 and verse 5. And notice the emphasis of this verse with his is on the idea of forethought, of planning, of diligence in planning. It says, "The plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty," in contrast to careful planning, "comes surely to poverty." So notice the road to poverty is in making hasty decisions rather than careful planning. And this all groups, therefore, under the idea of how does the righteous gain his money? Right action, hard work, planning his investment. And now third, how does he use it? We have now had his viewpoint on money, how he gains money, and now how he uses money. Number one is a negative. He does not use it for self-indulgence. He does not use it for self-indulgence. This is the way a righteous man uses his money. He does not use it for self-indulgence. Proverbs 25:16. 25:16. Here is a very colorful type thing. Have you ever experienced the principle that satiety creates ultimate loathing of something? Overindulgence. You overindulge. You're satiated, and then you come to hate it. I think I've expressed before that. It's only in the last 5 or 6 years that I have been able to eat potato salad, simply because I remember in Charlotte, North Carolina, I went to a home on weekends, and they always had potato salad, which I just loved, and I ate it and ate it and ate it and ate it and threw up, and now I hate it. And the idea was you overindulge, you get satiated, you can't hold anymore, and you get... Have you ever gotten sick on anything that you really loved, you really liked it, you overindulged, and now you can't stand it? And here is a very vivid picture of that in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 16, which says, "Have you found honey? Eat only what you need, lest you have it in excess and vomit it." So a very, very vivid expression of the idea that when you find something that is valuable and tasteful, don't use it in self-indulgence. And so the idea is, here is the man who has gained something very valuable and very useful. Don't overuse it, else you'll throw up on it. All right, Proverbs 21 and verse 17. Second substantiating point. It says, "He who loves pleasure will become a poor man." The emphasis is that he had the wherewithal to enjoy pleasure, but he loved it so much that he overindulged. And as a result of overindulgence, he is now a poor man. "He who loves wine and oil will not become rich." And they represent pleasurable things. And it's not the emphasis that he does not enjoy them. He comes to love them in the sense of overindulgence. All right? Number one point, then, on the use of money, he does not use it for self-indulgence. Number two is positive. He uses it to provide for his family. He uses it for his family. Proverbs 24:27. I think in Proverbs 24:27 that you really have an expression that tells us a very wise thing. One of the great difficulties that often occur in marriage revolves about finances, about money, namely the lack of it. And you try to get married without having adequate money, and it is very, very, very difficult. I think in this verse we have some teaching that before you build your house, and building a house in Proverbs and in the Old Testament is for marrying and having children and establishing a family. Before you do that, be sure you've got some money in the bank. Chapter 24, verse 7. "Prepare your work outside, make it ready for yourself in the field. That means you're getting your material possessions together. And afterwards, and I'm sorry, there's another one. Afterwards, then build your house. And notice that the building of the house is after there has been a certain degree of material preparation in terms of your fields and in prepare of your work. And that would point to the fact, get yourself established in your profession, get yourself established in your job, accumulate a little, and then build your house. And that is wise, wise advice. He uses it for his family. All right, chapter 27, verse 23. This goes through verse 27. Which says, verse 23, know well the condition of your flocks. Pay attention to your herds, for riches are not forever. And then come down to the results of paying attention to this. It says, verse 26, the lambs will be for your clothing. The goats will bring the price of a field. There will be goat's milk enough for your food, for the food of your household and the sustenance of your maidens. In other words, be diligent in your financial affairs so you'll have enough for your family and your household. The wise man uses his money to support his household. Third, he uses it to relieve the needs of others. He uses it to relieve the needy. One of the interesting things about Proverbs is going to say, if you're diligent and if you will work, you will provide for yourself. But hard work does more than make provision for yourself. You'll be able to provide for your family. But hard work does more than that. You'll be able to provide for your family and your whole household. But it does more than that. You can provide for yourself, your family, your household, and you'll have enough left over to give away. And that is important today when we live in an area where work is sort of depreciated and it's not a very important thing. And when the book of Proverbs says, the hard-working man provides for himself, his family, and everybody else, if we would only do it. Okay, chapter 3, verse 27. What kind of condition would we have in our country if everybody was determined to work hard to gain material things? Verse 27, negatively speaking, says, do not withhold good from those whom it is due, when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give when you have it with you. So the emphasis is on generosity. Chapter 19, verse 17. There's a lot of this in Proverbs. 19, 17. Here's a colorful, very colorful proverb. It says, he who is gracious to a poor man lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his good deed. So that's an interesting perspective, is that when there is a legitimate need and we are gracious with material things, that God says, I consider that as a loan to me. And of course, when you consider it as a loan to God, God always repays his loans. 22:9. Says, he who is generous will be blessed, for he gives some of his food to the poor. Chapter 28, verse 27. Proverbs has a lot about generosity. It says, he who gives to the poor, this is 28:27. He who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. All right, so he uses it to relieve the needy. Finally, he uses it to give to the Lord. He uses it to give to the Lord. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 9. Proverbs 3:9 reads, honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce. So your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will overflow with new wine. So then, four things about the way the righteous uses his money. He uses it not for self-indulgence, to clothe his family, to relieve the needy, and he uses it to give to the Lord. All right? Now we're ready to go back to Proverbs 6 and at least get a start in the last 15 minutes. Remember, we key off of chapter 6 from chapter 5. Chapter 5 closed out with the picture of these words. It says, in the greatness of his folly, he will reel. And so the picture is of a reeling man in his folly. And chapter 6 is concrete examples. Example number 1 is the example of the cosigner, or the folly of cosigning. And now we're ready to take verses 6 through 11 and at least get a start on the folly of the sluggard. The sluggard gave me a very, very difficult time this week. Simply because we're writing each one of these up in terms of a portrait. And I got started on the sluggard this week on what his portrait would be. And I ended up staying here till about 8:30 last night because there was no way I could get up and teach and say, I've started writing the portrait of a sluggard and I'm half finished. So I had to finish it because I couldn't stand to make that announcement this morning, and I wanted to be loud and clear that the portrait of the sluggard in the book of Proverbs is finished. And I hope, God, did you hear? Okay. Okay, chapter 6, verses 6 through 11, and we're looking at the folly of the sluggard, or how to guarantee poverty. And we begin with the command to the sluggard in 6:6. And the first command that is given to the sluggard in verse 6 is an interesting one. It is a command to look at the ant. And that emphasizes a principle we have in Scripture. And that is the fact that man is to learn from animals. Man is to learn from animals. And we do not often emphasize that point, but the wisdom involved here, though it may seem a little bit degrading, is that your dog just might be smarter than you are. And we know that our cats are smart. So the emphasis here is, notice it very clear in verse 6, is go to the ant. And the ant is a very humble type creature, but he's simply saying, sluggard, if you would look at part of God's creation, namely that little old ant, you will learn something. Go over also to chapter 30 of the same book, and you have the same emphasis again. Man is told that there is something to learn from God's animal creation. Chapter 30 and verse 25 says, the ants, again, are not a strong folk, but they prepare their food in the summer. Verse 26, the badgers are not a mighty folk. Verse 27, the locusts. Verse 28, the lizard. And notice, therefore, the emphasis on these animals. Go to Job chapter 12. And you have again an emphasis that there is something for man to learn from observing God's animal creation. Why did God create the ant? So that man would learn something from the ant and the lizard and the badger. Verse 7, he says, but now, chapter 12, verse 7 of Job, but now ask the beasts, and let them teach you. And the birds of the heaven, let them tell you. Or speak to the earth, and let it teach you. And let the fish of the sea declare to you. So notice the emphasis is established, and let's go back to Proverbs 6. That when the sluggard is exhorted to go to the ant, you have a principle. And the principle is there is something to learn from God's animal creation. You often wonder, you look at an ant, you look at a list. Why did God make those things? Those are his little educators, and we are to observe them and learn from them. Okay, Now, what is it that we're going to learn from the ant? Man is to learn from animals, and here in particular, the ant. And that, therefore, we ought to ask, what is it he is to learn? There are three things that will describe the ant. One, industry. Two, foresight. Three, preparation. And those are good lessons in life. It is good to learn to be industrious. You can learn that from the ant. And it is a wise person that has foresight to think about tomorrow. You can learn that from the animal creation. And it is wise in the light of what you see coming tomorrow to make preparation for it. And the ant will describe all of these things in our context. So verse 6, go to the ant. And the emphasis will be on industry, foresight, and preparation. O sluggard. And so let's introduce him and say several things about the sluggard. The word sluggard, though we do not use it much in English today, comes from a verb simply meaning to be slow, to be sluggish. Lazy is the idea. This person is one of the most pitiful characters in Proverbs. One of his characteristics is you can paint him so vividly, as Proverbs will, and yet he doesn't recognize himself. He also comes to the point that he is so used to finding excuses for not working that he hallucinates over it. He says, there's a lion in the street, when there's nothing in the streets, emphasizing he will go to every excuse to avoid hard work. The first thing we can say about the sluggard, however, is you will find him nowhere except in Proverbs. The word for sluggard is only in Proverbs. Therefore, you could read and read and read, and you might find examples of lazy people, but when you come to putting the finger on the sluggard, only the book of Proverbs does it, and it will do it 16 times. The second thing that we ought to say about him is he is probably the easiest to identify with, simply because all of us have his characteristics. At least some of them. I think of all the Proverbs we've gone through and all of the characteristics, I've had more application to the sluggard than any other. And I am very regretfully, we studied him because he bothers me every day coming back with the things we've learned about him. And I'm forever finding myself quitting early, doing less, and this man keeps knocking on my door. And so since he has been knocking on my door, I hope that I can lay a trip on you that you won't believe. Okay, now notice what he is to do. It says, go to the ant, O sluggard, and observe her ways. Her ways refers to the habits of the ant, the manner of living of the ant. And as a result, what will happen? You will be wise. The word for wise is our word that we discussed in the beginning of Proverbs for skill for living. So go to the ant, O sluggard, observe the way she conducts herself, and you will develop skill for living. Now, two observations about the sluggard. Number one, these are important ones. The sluggard in Proverbs is not a freak. The sluggard in Proverbs is an ordinary man who has made too many postponements in life. So he is not a freak. Don't think of the sluggard as some kind of guy slouched under a tree with his hat pulled down with a weed in his mouth or sitting there doing nothing. That may be part of it, but he's not a freak. He is an ordinary person who procrastinates. He is a man who procrastinates, who puts off. And when we talk about putting off responsibilities, we can be assured that sitting within this auditorium or whatever number is here, we all are sluggards. We all have a characteristic like this in us. So he is not a freak. The second observation to say about him is that being a sluggard is one of the greatest pleasures in life. And the reason we know it is pictured as one of life's great pleasures is the sluggard is pictured over and over of a man who folds his hands in sleep. And what is more pleasurable than sleeping? One of life's great pleasures, it is like sleep. And it is interesting that he gets pictured in that way. Over and over, he folds his hands for a little more sleep, and being a sluggard is like going to sleep. And I don't know about you, but I don't you enjoy sleep? I enjoy sleep most of all in the early hours of the morning when it's time to get up. It is just, think of the irrational things you go through. How can you believe that you could look over and have one more minute before the alarm goes off? And what do? Do you ever relish and enjoy 60 seconds of what? Sleep. And consequently, that's the picture of the sluggard, and therefore being a sluggard is fun. All right, back to the text now. And we'll put number one, the command to the sluggard. And let's assume that the sluggard is going to obey the command, and now he is, we're watching him as he walks off into the field, and he's got a little notebook and a pencil in his hand, and he's going to learn about the ant. So we have number two, after the command, we have the observations of a sluggard. Command two, observations of, and the observations of the sluggard come down in verses 7 and 8. Verse 7, which ants, having no chief, no officer, no ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. What can we say about the ant? The ant is a self-starter. The ant is a self-starter. Now, how do we know that's what he's saying? Well, we know that's what he is saying simply because the ant does her work with no supervisors. There's no chief out there saying, "Ant, go to work." And there's no officer. The interesting thing about the word officer, by the way, that's the same word used in the book of Exodus for the taskmasters over that the Egyptians put over the Jews. They put out taskmasters to make them gather straw and brick. And the emphasis of the taskmaster is we'll get more work out of them. But not the ant. The ant doesn't need a taskmaster, so she has no chief, no ruler, no officer to pull her. She is a self-starter. Now, is there anything to learn from that? How many people are self-starters? How many people will work hard whether or not the boss is around? It makes no difference. What if where you work, you would pull off all of the supervisors and simply say, "Worker, just work." How many self-starters will you have? You probably won't. Most businessmen know you ever notice a restaurant? Can't you almost always tell if the owner's there? You gone in a restaurant one time and the service and everything was super. You went back the next time and you look around for the owner and he's not there today. And what happens? You wait 20 minutes for a waitress and you recognize that most people don't have the sense of an ant, because the ant is able to be a self-starter. Another interesting observation coming off of this, verse 6, and I'm not knocking these because they're worthwhile and profitable. I just want to make a point about the value of God's Word if we'll really take it seriously. You are aware, are you not, that there are many, many seminars around the country that are designed for a fee to motivate salesmen and students and so forth to really get in there and be aggressive, and you pay for those. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you get a chance, many of you might find it well worthwhile, but I might just make this comment. Notice the value of the Word of God. If we would listen to Proverbs 6:6 and go to the ant, how much will the lesson cost us? Not a nickel. Absolutely free. And it points to the value of the Word of God, how we can progress in life if we will only listen to it. So the ant is a self-starter. Very good example of it. Second, the ant distinguishes time. The ant distinguishes time. Now, how do we get that? Notice in verse 8, she makes a distinction between summer and winter. It says she prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. And the contrast is, to the sluggard, all time is alike. Because the sluggard does have a preference of time, and what would his preference of time be? He would always prefer tomorrow. And therefore, the emphasis is, the ant recognizes that there is summer and there is winter. And there is a difference between these two. And it is appropriate in the appropriate time that I work now in the light of the distinction I make between the coming winter. Basically, in Palestine, there are two species of ants. And one of the interesting things, since this is in a Palestinian setting, is that the two species of ants, basically black and white, both of them are strictly seed feeders. And that means you gather food in the summer or you die. And consequently, you have the second characteristic of the ant. She distinguishes time. And that can be very difficult to do, can it not? Because one of the easiest things to do is to recognize, I've got this due down the line. Put it in a context of school. We're just starting. That paper is due on October 27th. And after all, this is only the 1st of September. And consequently, unlike the ant, who would start on the paper now and distinguish that now is the time of opportunity and the deadline is coming, what do we all do? We will wait to October 26th and we will eat supper and say, well, after supper, oh no, just a little TV. And then at 10 o'clock, when you're half awake, you will take some pills in order to prop you up and write the paper so you can get it in, and you'll stay up all night. You know, so you'll be super fit for the next day, not even half as smart as that little thing crawling across the floor called an ant. And that is part of the wisdom that is here. The standard work on Palestine, pretty much the standard work in the past years, has been by Thompson called The Land and the Book. He has an interesting paragraph about the Palestinian ant, and I've copied it down to read for you. It says, leave a bushel of wheat in the vicinity of one of their subterranean cities, and in a surprisingly short time, the whole commonwealth will be summoned to plunder. A broad black column stretches from the wheat to their hole, and you are startled by the results. As if by magic, every grain seems to be accommodated with legs, walks off in a hurry along the moving column. The farmers remorselessly set fire to every ant city they find in the neighborhood of their threshing floors. And that emphasizes the ant. All right, we can say one third thing now about the ant, and it's an important one. Verse 8, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. Can you relate this to something else we've studied? The ant is a creature that recognizes there is an afterwards. The ant recognizes the afterwards. She knows that to summer, there is an afterwards, and the afterwards is called winter. And as a result, she considers it. And going back and reflecting on the afterwards which we have studied, isn't it interesting that this little creature is probably smarter than man? Man who has the greatest capacity for thought, man who has the capacity for fellowship with God, lumbers through life, stupid ox that he, well, we shouldn't say ox, because the ox is probably one of those smart creatures too. Stupid being that he be, it's good that God didn't say to the ant, behold intelligent man. Because if the ant beheld intelligent man, the ant would starve to death in winter because man is basically a sluggard. All right? I don't know whether to stop or... No, I'm not going to do that. Let's finish out the passage. Then we'll... Okay, we have the command to, the observations, and now we're going to address the sluggard. The address to, verses 9 through 11. Notice in verse 9, he is addressed, and the address says, how long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? So notice the question is, how long and when? How long and when? And I want you to notice that to that question, the sluggard doesn't have an answer. when it says how long, he doesn't say 5 minutes. Notice he doesn't say never either. When he says how long are you going to sleep, when will you rise, he doesn't say never. He doesn't say I'm permanently in bed. He responds by what words? Well, notice in verse 11, 10, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands. So the answer to how long and when is just a little longer, just a little more. And noticing he doesn't say never, he wants just a little more time to relax. And so the emphasis is the sluggard surrenders the opportunities of life one inch at a time. A little more sleep, and there's an inch of opportunity gone. A little more relaxation, and there's another opportunity gone. And a little more recreation, and there is a more opportunity gone. Life surrendered one inch at a time. Isn't that the way most of us do it? In relative to opportunities and jobs we've got to do, how do we surrender an opportunity? Suddenly, usually gradually. This is the picture of the sluggard. He does it so gradually, he doesn't know what's happening to him. He's like the frog that is sitting in the pot of cool water and it feels so good. And he does not recognize that there's a flame under the pot. And slowly the water will get a little bit warmer, but it feels good. And inch by inch, and pretty soon we have a boiled frog. Okay. Notice when, then also, when you do get the sluggard awake, what's he want? More sleep. He doesn't awake to work, he awakes only to want more sleep. Okay, now what is going to be the end of him? Where will he end up? And the end will be involved in 2 points. Sudden poverty is first. And that is found in chapter 6, verse 10 and 11. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And your poverty will come in like a vagabond. This is all going to express sudden poverty. The vagabond is simply a Hebrew word for walk in the intensive stem. Runner. It's like a runner. I don't know. I really don't agree with the taking the word walk, putting it in an intensive form. When you walk intensely, what are you doing? You're running. An intense walk is a run. And so the figure involved in verse 11 is your poverty comes in like a runner. And the idea is, picture a purse snatcher. You know, you're just coasting along real fine. Someone grabs your purse and zip, they're gone. And he says, that's what happens to the sluggard. He's just drifting along real great. Things are going fine. And someone grabs his purse and he's gone, and now you're in poverty. And second, your needs like an armed man. The armed man is literally man of shield. And so the idea would be the picture of a soldier who plunders a city. Sudden poverty. He suddenly wakes up and says, it's too late. I'm poor. I've waited too long. I've frittered away life. Sudden poverty. Second, and here is the ironical thing about it. If you will not work, do you know where you will end up eventually? Forced labor. So, certain drudgery. I'll show you that in just a moment. Sudden drudgery. By looking at Proverbs 12, verse 24. Ironical thing. He puts off work so long that there's nothing left for him but the workhouse. And the guy that was diligent hires him for $2 an hour. 12:24. The hand of the diligent will rule. Very interesting that this man has been diligent. This is the ant that's been diligent. And as a result, he has a pleasant task. Now he can run the show. He can rule. But the slack hand will be put to forced labor. And so the interesting thing, through shirking hard work, he qualifies himself for drudgery. The man who is diligent now has the pleasant task of ruling. That is the end of the sluggard. All right, next Sunday at 10, then, we will take the rest of the passages that deal with him. And let me give you what I was going to conclude with, except now this is a hard task, and it's a very heavy thing. But let me tell you in 3 points a program for not being a sluggard. It's tough, tough, tough. Point one. And the point one is something to do in your mind. Point one is distinguish what must be done from what you would like to do. That's tough. Distinguish what must and needs to be done. Put must and needs both. Distinguish what must and needs to be done from what you would like to do. That's the first step. Second step is get out a piece of paper and write down what must be done and what needs to be done. 1, 2, 3, 4. That will commit it in your mind. And number 3, plan a schedule to get it done. I dare you. Do it. I will join you. I plan to, before I leave tonight, I plan to do that for this week. I'm going to put down what needs to be done, and I'm going to list it. And then I am going to take the second step of planning a schedule on how it is going to get done and do it. And don't you dare ask any questions. Father, we're thankful for the wisdom of your word. We pray honestly that each of us will recognize that we need to get a hold of ourselves and recognize that it is not wrong to do the things that we would like to do. But may we distinguish where we are allowing that to determine our whole schedule. And we work only in order to get to what we would like to do. We work only to rest. And may we recognize that this is the road to poverty. And this is not the road of the diligent who will rule and have responsibility. And therefore, this week, help us to recognize that while the things we would like to do are not wrong necessarily, but they are not to be first. And may we recognize that the real producers in this life, and as believers, we ought to be on that list, who know you, the real producers in your life, in this life, are the ones who see duty first and responsibility first and what needs to be done first. And then they take the effort and plan the schedule to get the job done. May we do this effectively this week in Christ's name.